Hello, I'm Rachel Gilmore, your least favorite person's least favorite journalist. Welcome to Bubble Pop. This is the weekly show where we talk about some of the biggest headlines and juiciest news tidbits so you don't have to doom scroll. And you guys know the drill by now. We're doing it live for season two. So if you guys want to support the show, as usual, you can subscribe on Patreon, Substack, YouTube, and anywhere you like to listen. And just a reminder that I'm going to try to leave about 10 minutes at the end of the episode for live chat questions. You can leave those in the chat using the super chat function on YouTube. But also, I'll just try to take some general questions. So don't be shy if you still want to ask one and don't feel like using the super chat. Today, there is a lot to talk about. The Alberta government just signed a memorandum of understanding with the federal government that lays out the conditions for a new oil pipeline. Awesome. Well, it's very unlikely that this pipeline will come to be, given Coastal First Nations and BC aren't too keen on it, to put things lightly. And it also needs a private proponent. Carney does seem to be trying to de-risk the idea of a pipeline for a potential private investor, including telling them that he'd be willing to, quote, adjust the tanker ban off the coast of BC, which protects those waters from oil spills. Overall, he's managed to piss off Coastal First Nations, BC, the Bloc Québécois, the Green Party, and one of his own cabinet ministers who just resigned from cabinet, all to placate Alberta, the same province that is addicted to invoking the notwithstanding clause, primarily using it to trample on the rights of trans kids. Yeah, I said we got a lot to talk about, didn't I? Luckily, we've got some great guests on the show today to help me do it. In just a few seconds, we'll be joined by Dr. Victoria Buchholz. I practiced that, aka Carla Marx. She is the Alberta organizer for the 2SLGBTQ plus rights group Queer Momentum. We're also getting ready to see a recent guest all over again, which is super nice of her to be so generous with her time. BC Green Party leader Emily Lowen is a climate activist and organizer and the first Gen Zer to lead an official party in Canada. Emily, Victoria, welcome to Bubble Pop.
It's great to be back so soon.
I so appreciate it. Okay, the first thing I have to ask you, Emily, who did you think you were saying fuck online? Like, that was just unbelievable.
How dare I, frankly?
Yeah, really? I mean, it's not like the situation merits it, right?
No, you know, all these old men in their armchairs are, you know, getting up with banging fists. I think, you know, it was well worth it. But, you know, Andrew Weaver, he's just mad that everyone he's politically backed since he left office has lost. Like, I don't know. There seems to be some grudge happening there. And yeah, he was, you know, also openly angry that I won this leadership race, and said that he felt politically homeless now, despite having backed, you know, the conservative leader John Rustad and other political parties since. So, you know, let's not pay attention to that guy. We can get him back to bed.
Oh my God, that's funny. Okay, so putting him to bed, let's focus on what actually made you say fuck. What the hell is going on with this pipeline deal? I want both of your reaction. Emily, since I'm already talking to you, I'll let you go first. And then Carla, I'm bringing you in here.
This is just, it is such a spit in the face to British Columbians and Coastal First Nations. We've made it abundantly clear over the past weeks and months that there will be no oil pipeline to BC's coasts. And, you know, going behind our back, Carney and Smith signing this MOU, pouring their support behind this project, is an abuse of power. You know, it's completely unacceptable. And you know, I'm really just reeling with the proposal itself. We're looking at a massive affordability crisis. People are struggling to make ends meet. Our grocery costs are sky high. We're spending half our income on rent. And, you know, the government can't afford to pay for libraries and shelters, but they somehow have billions of dollars for a new oil pipeline that has no global market attached to it. You know, we've tried this with Northern Gateway a decade ago, and that project was canceled, Enbridge pulled its support from that project a decade ago because of Coastal First Nations opposition. And their opposition hasn't moved a single inch. And so I don't think tricks Smith has her up her sleeve to think that position will be reversed and that suddenly there'll be a private proponent wanting to take on an economic loser of a project that'll take at least $50 billion to ram through Indigenous territory. But yeah, it's completely ludicrous. And so in a time where, somehow it's easier to socialize a project of that scale than to support communities across BC and across this country with truly sustainable economies that would support the cost of living crisis. You know, it's safe to say I'm banging my head against the wall.
no, yeah,
we're ready to escalate whatever comes our way.
Interesting. Carla, what about you? Like, what's the vibe in Alberta like right now? I imagine maybe mixed depending on which social circles you're in, but what are your thoughts on all of this, especially in the broader context, of all the stuff that Alberta has recently been doing to its most vulnerable citizens?
Well, first and foremost, I think as an Albertan on a national podcast, I have to apologize. so sorry. I think we have to reset the counter again. It's still 0 days since Alberta has been a national embarrassment. Just really want to say we're sorry. Oh, geez. I kind of look at this through the lens of like, what is everybody trying to get here? It's obvious for Danielle Smith that she doesn't really care about what Albertans actually want. She is the premier of oil companies. Like, she goes around the world to advocate specifically for the oil industry. She's shut down anything that would look at renewables or green energy. She's put a moratorium on that, saying it's a blight on the environment, but open coal mines, that's okay, on sacred Indigenous territory that's going to poison most of Southern Alberta. That's fine, because that helps what she likes. So she's not even a politician for Albertans. She looks for very specific industries that she backs. So that's very clear. You know, she's kind of gone back to like the original Albertans of just being a boondoggle in a trench coat. I also don't really think Danielle Smith has principles per se. We're kind of all sick of playing the game of like, you take a clip of 2015 Danielle Smith and compare it to 2025 and it says the exact opposite. And then she's got her tinfoil hat era when she was on like these podcasts and like the COVID era. So, I mean, she's really willing to say whatever helps her stay in power, and she thinks that these big corporations are going to do that. But we're projected at a $6.4 billion deficit in our budget because it's so reliant on oil. And it shows just how bad the math is and unimaginative this is to really serve people. And that's where I think Carney's biggest issue is, because I've tried to put myself in the mindset of like Mark Carney, so I swore at a woman. And then I tried to like figure out like, why would he make this deal? Is he playing 3D chess and he's trying to placate Alberta to defang the Conservatives to say, look, I stood up for you on pipelines knowing that it won't work. But then like, is he passing the buck on to British Columbians and Indigenous groups who are actually going to have to stand up and say, no, this isn't? So is he like ducking this to be a coward? And he's trying to play political chess with Danielle Smith so she just stops railing against him all the time? Or I think he spent too long in the boardroom. Like, he thinks too much in the terms of corporations. He thinks too much in the terms of this all masculine community of straight, cis, old white guys who go and drink their scotch back at the club, go to their house, have people clean their thing. Like, this is not a man of the people. This is not somebody who's out there on the streets who understands that a lot of people would like a livable planet in 20 years. 30 years, 40 years, you know, that this is really not serving people. And I think what we're seeing is Emily represents a massive shift in the political landscape that these old dinosaurs are missing, that the politics of usual are over. People are waking up to the radical extremists that are being platformed by conservative parties. and that increasingly people are saying, I'm sick of this centrist BS and I want a progressive future, and that there's so many of us. The NDP, like especially in Alberta with Nenshi, is chasing votes to the right, thinking, well, no one's going to out-left us. And I saw Nenshi's tweet today saying, yay, a pipeline. And then a subtweet underneath saying, like, well, and we should do other things too. And I really am at odds because, going back to kind of your introduction to me, I love what the NDP is saying about human rights. I love what they're saying about trans rights and about standing up for the rights of workers. But then they go and do these centrist moves like this, and it really makes it kind of like, ugh, I really wish we could have a party that was like wholly progressive and not this, well, we're going to be progressive here, but then, yeah, drill, baby, drill. Let's get oil pipelines. Like, I just think that politicians that are taking a principled stance like Emily, like Zoran Mandami, like Zach Polansky, like, they're showing, hey, if you chase these votes to the right and become a center-center-right party, at your own peril.
Emily, I'm curious if you want to dig in a little bit more to that idea. I mean, the one thing that we always hear about these pipeline investments is that, oh, well, you know, this is balancing the economy and like considering the economy. And it's always an economic argument for more extraction. But I don't really see how that entirely makes sense when like a pipeline would cost a ton of money, wouldn't actually be constructed. Generally, they take about a decade, I believe. And so it's like you're talking about extracting oil and getting oil to market in 10 years. So it's not like, you know, Trump will probably not be with us anymore by then. So, you know, I just, there's all these discussions about the strategicness of this, but can you drill down a little bit, sorry, on, you know, that sort of economic argument and whether you buy it?
Yeah, shocking news. I don't buy it at all.
Really? I thought you would. Just kidding.
But,
sorry.
You know, I will say what it does feel like a shock doctrine that we're living through right now, because, you know, this kind of goes back to our experience in the spring around the federal election. Mark Carney won on an elbows up election against Donald Trump. And through that period, Trump was unleashing a new wave of fossil fever across Canada, where, you know, because I think there's that sort of guttural fear that Canadians felt about, you know, our sovereignty, and some deep historical us versus them dynamics with the US. And I think that unleashes like monkey brain, where we say that, you know, we need this economic security, and we need to do what we've always done. And we've always been a rip it and ship it resource economy that has just, you know, relied so heavily on oil and gas. And though, you know, it is a shrinking share of our GDP as a country, and it is, you know, across the board, not an enormous number of jobs. I can speak to BC. Our oil and gas revenue is lower than the money we make off of lottery and casinos. And so, you know, that just goes to show sort of our need to really transition relative to so many other countries, and our relative ability to do so as a rich global North country who's got us into this mess in the first place. And so, yeah, I think when we talk about the economics of it, you know, I just want to talk about Northern Gateway again. Like, Northern Gateway, the Enbridge project was pulled out, yes, because of a lack of support from coastal First Nations, but they saw the writing on the wall for the economic markets for this project as well. You know, it was a combination of factors, and that's been true across so many of these canceled projects across the country that we've seen over the last decade. You know, and with Energy East as well, with so many of these projects that are now seeing a revival. And I want to shake this political amnesia, because the markets have only gotten worse. And we've saw this conclusion start to finish with the Trans Mountain pipeline. Taxpayers have now paid in about $50 billion into this project that does not operate at full capacity because there's not demand for it, you know, and oil demand is in a slump and it's not going to recover. And it's a similar case with liquefied natural gas, which EB is massively propping up. And it's a very similar story. We're seeing a global supply glut for 2030, and BC is going to be the highest cost late market entrant for this market. And so across the board, these are climate disasters. We cannot continue expanding oil and gas, LNG. It's a hard no from a climate standpoint. And it's economically stupid. I'll leave it there.
I just want to say,
Emily, stay in your lane. How dare you talk about transitions? That's
really inconsiderate, Emily. Yeah. Wow. This is her first big scandal. She's actually canceled now. So you heard it here first, folks, on Bubble Pop.
On Bubble Pop.
Yeah. Go ahead, Carla.
I think this is bad math, and we're always told that these are the guys who understand stonks and math, and us silly girls, we just don't get it. We're just out here like trying to these guys are naked corrupt. They are just trying to help out their corporation buddies. And we need politicians that work for us, that work for the people. And we have to stop measuring, is the economy good, by what are the stock portfolios of the richest 10 guys look like. Like, this is not what we want to be measuring on. I want to measure it by what's our houseless rate. I want to measure it by, can people afford their own homes? Are groceries affordable? What is the percentage of our workers who are being paid a minimum wage, a living wage? You know, that's what I want to be looking at. Those are the economic indicators that matter to me. And I think to matter people who vote, because like oil companies don't vote. People do. And we need to educate them on that there is a better way out there.
Yeah. No, exactly. And I will, on the note of corruption, I mean, we should have seen this coming, right? Carney nominated the former executive CEO of Trans Mountain Pipeline to lead his major projects office.
Why do we need another pipeline? We're already shipping oil at record paces through Trans Mountain to the coast. Like, they're acting like there is no pipeline in place, and there already is. Like, ask the town of Jasper, that already rolled through. Like, there already are pipelines that aren't at full capacity. It just seems like they're tilting at windmills. They're chasing this, like, oil equals job equals good. And what, Imperial just announced yesterday they're cutting 20% of their labor force, and that's going to massively cut Calgary again. Like, the jobs aren't there. I absolutely think we need to create a national energy company that is focused on green solutions. Like, why can't we do this? If we are taking our public dollars and we are investing them in privately run and partnered pipelines, why can't we take those same dollars and create a publicly funded, publicly profitable energy company that focuses on wind and solar? Because we know that those are profitable. Let's do that. Why don't we invest in ourselves and we own it? We have assets then.
I think public options, just those words, terrify people. And then next thing you know, Pierre Poilievre's posting about how the Nazis were socialists or whatever again, which, to be clear, is incorrect. But anyway,
Carla Marx.
So I know.
Solution. You're going to be surprised how left-wing I'm willing to go on this. Mean Girls, the limit does not exist.
Oh, hell yeah. And I did want to dive into the politics a little bit too, because the thing that I keep hearing, particularly from sort of liberal partisans, is that, oh, Carney's playing 4D chess here, okay? Like, he is, placating Alberta with a toy that's never actually going to be real and getting concessions in the form of, I guess, stripping back several environmental regulations. But anyway, for like a potential increase to the industrial carbon price, but the calculation doesn't make great sense there. But even beyond that, what's blowing my mind is, there's talk of this being cooperative federalism. For example, Carney said that this is an example of cooperative federalism, and BC wasn't at the table for this, and the pipeline goes through BC. And meanwhile, obviously, that's got Quebec freaked out because Quebec is not a fan of the federal government doing stuff that impacts a province with a provincial involvement. And Indigenous communities are pissed. The Green Party federally is pissed. I'm assuming the Green Party of BC is pissed based on Emily's use of the word, God forbid, fuck. And his own cabinet. I mean, we're hearing murmurs of BCMPs, the discontent in the meeting leading up to this announcement. We've got Stephen Guilbeault resigning, which is actually a very big deal in Quebec. And, you know, he's still staying in the Liberal caucus. But broadly, I'm just kind of wondering what makes this 4D chess when he's pissed off so many groups and two provinces in exchange for placating Alberta, which will probably turn on him the next opportunity it's politically expedient. So I'm curious, like, what you guys make of those 4D chess claims and the politics of this in general. Do you think that there was any smart politicking here?
I think it is 4D chess in the sense that 4D chess doesn't exist.
I knew you were gonna pull some.
It doesn't exist. It's the invention of bored bros to justify playing the same games. And that's what we're seeing. It's not 4D chess. It goes back to like McDonald of like exactly what Emily was saying. We're going to extract. We're going to pull things out of the earth. We're going to sell them on market. That's what they're saying. And I think everybody is saying, like, we've been doing this 150 years. Can we start investing in this country? Can we start making solutions that profit us instead of corporate interests? And it's just, it's so frustrating that we're still in the same place. I do not think this is 4D chess. I think this is same old corporate Canada, just extracting wealth and pumping it around as much as they can. I do think there's an argument that maybe he knows it won't work, and he's trying to placate Danielle Smith so she just shuts up, which, good luck, she doesn't ever. She will come up with some new bullshit tomorrow.
Yeah, no, placating Alberta is a losing game, and
for those of you on audio only, Carla just did a very exaggerated offended face, so that's why we're all laughing.
A full gay Albertan gasp.
Yeah.
we've seen it's a losing game on just about every single issue, so, you know, There was a moment where I bought into the 4D chess argument in April, and I was like, oh, maybe he's just like, you know, swatting Alberta away, sort of trying to kick the can down the line because things are tense with the election, and, you know, things are, you know, I was still struggling to find the rationale then, but now, you know, after his cabinet appointments, after, you know, his staffing of the major projects office, seeing, you know, who he's meeting, how he's dealing with Trump. I think we saw a very similar playbook in his recent meetings with Trump, and you saw those same people saying, oh, he's playing 4D chess, he's just, you know, trying to be chummy and placate him in these ways. And yeah, I think it's a very similar dynamic here. And I'm not sure what the calculus is, but from a BC perspective, he's cowing to pressure, and he is steamrolling the rights of coastal First Nations and British Columbians. And so I don't really care what the calculus is. I care what the outcome is.
Yeah. And, you know, the other thing that's struck me, and I don't see anyone else like saying this, so you guys can let me know if I'm tying together two things that don't belong together, but I really find it to be a bad signal that he's sending in giving Alberta this at least optical win. And I think in many ways it very much is being framed as that by Danielle Smith as a huge win for Alberta. Just barely over a week after Danielle Smith invoked the notwithstanding clause for three anti-trans laws to protect them from court challenges. And that comes after, that's the fourth time in a month that she's used it. And before then, she used the notwithstanding clause, which is the clause in the charter that allows you to override other charter rights for up to 5 years to pass legislation. Used it to violate workers' rights and force striking teachers back to work. So I just think it's a very interesting signal, particularly when it comes to trans kids and the way they're under attack in Alberta, to 1 week later give that effectively reward to Alberta and signal that it doesn't matter what she does to trans kids in the province, she'll still get her pipeline. There won't be pushback. There's no mention of it in any negotiations here. You know, when you've got leverage, you're not going to use it to protect the most vulnerable. It just, I find that really galling. And I'm shocked that more people aren't mentioning those two things together. But maybe I'm off base there. Carla, I'm curious what you make of this and what signal you think it sends.
Well, I think that they go hand in glove in the sense that, I mean, a place with human rights abuses and a bunch of oil sounds like an attractive place to Mark Carney. If we look at his track record everywhere, he's like, oh, I feel at home here. We've got a wannabe dictator, a bunch of oil in the ground, and human rights abuses. Let's make a deal. No, I think it's really quite reprehensible. And I think we've seen this from the federal government recently, like with their proposed cuts to wage that I think only really, you know, through a lot of the work done by Momentum and Faye and a huge campaign of organizations that rallied together to push back and secure wage funding in October, you know, that only happened because there was huge outcry against it. But he didn't think twice about slashing budgets that do a lot of amazing things. And what we're seeing is, I know people are calling him a blue liberal.
Red Tory.
Tory, at least. Like, I just think he's probably one of the most effective progressive conservative prime ministers in the history of that party. And this is not a man who has liberal values. This is not a man who has left-wing values by any standpoint. And so I think that it gets back to kind of a settler colonial mentality that you see that humans are just resources to use to extract wealth. You know, when you think of the earth as just something to be bought, sold, traded, and exploited, you tend to apply that to people as well. And it's really quite terrifying. I also think that there is a dangerous pattern happening here for trans folks. And that is that the attacks on us are getting already forgotten by news cycles. That we, unless there's new attacks when Daniel Smith is up for election in 2027, are people going to remember what's happened to us? Are people going to remember what happened here? Because now we're already talking about pipelines. We're already, you know, I was up there for the throne speech when Daniel Smith dropped a new dog whistle, the social engineering of children. She leveled that against us as trans.
What?
It's in the throne speech. Oh my God. It's in the throne speech. Yeah.
I'm so sorry.
It wow. was shocking for sure.
Yeah.
And you know, we're seeing these kinds of attacks, but the nurses had a giant demonstration outside the legislature. So everyone said, you know what, we'd love to talk to you about trans issues, but put a pin in that, here's my card, but we got to go talk about the teachers. And what I'm worried about is by the next time we have a chance in Alberta, and even federally, there's always going to be another crisis. And the rights of a small group, mine, you know, less than 1% of the population, are we going to be forgotten by the new crisis du jour? And that's a feature of these capitalist extractive economies. There's always a new crisis. So we never have time for human rights. We always have to deal with the new crisis. And it always seems to be Daniel Smith in a pipeline or, you know, something like that. But these long-term principled stands, we don't have time for that. And I think Emily's win is really exciting because it shows that there's a generation, that it shows that there's a movement in this country that mirrors what's going on in the rest of the world and saying, no, actually, politics can stand for something and we can actually work towards a vision that maybe has a little bit of a different tone.
Yeah. Emily, do you have any reaction to that?
I'm so touched. That's so kind, Carla. And yeah, I mean, I feel like since starting the campaign back in July, it's just, I feel like we tapped into that hunger. And I like it. it's been just overwhelming to see the fire from the younger generations across BC who I think have been waiting for this for a long time to feel represented and to feel like, you know, their voice and concerns really matter, and that we're actually, you know, building up a movement with the fire to take on the governing party and to channel the power of people across BC into government. And you know, I think you tapped into something so accurate that we are so consumed by, you know, crazy right-wing culture war debates that distract us from the emergency of the cost of living crisis and the need to, you know, have real public options to offer, you know, good union jobs across this province and country, and, you know, really step up for working people, lower the cost of living, control the rent, and ensure that you know, we have a sustainable future to be building towards, and that we're not getting so caught up in these ridiculous distractions of a taxpayer-funded pipeline.
And I think that what they're missing is like the broader arc of history when you look at where does political activity really happen in a society? And a lot of times it happens because they have their material goods needs met, right? They've got a stable home, they got a stable job, their family's taken care of. So they have a little bit of extra capacity to take on political work and activism and action. But that's this zone here. But we've moved people down further and further and further where they're more destitute, they're more precarious. And eventually people are going to get so precarious that they're not going to have any investment in the established system. They're going to be so destitute that they're going to say, well, what do I have to risk? And that's when things get really scary. That's when like major revolutions happen, because people are so disenfranchised by a system that they don't see any way to fix it and reform it. And they say, let's tear it down. And there's not always a prediction of that that's going to be a good thing or a bad thing. And that's really scary to me. The idea that, you know, there's just this downward pressure on folks right now, especially with like affordability, that, I mean, it's lovely that we call it affordability. It's corporate greed. It's corporate greed.
Exactly.
Right? Like
exactly.
Record profits on one hand, and then everyone's so broke on the other hand. Put it together. The corporations are gouging us, and there's no laws stopping them from doing this. Monopoly laws are a joke, and our government is in bed with corporations. Instead of working for our votes, they're working to make corporations happy and make stocks go up instead of making people happy and healthy in their country. It's ridiculous.
Yeah. And I liked earlier that you mentioned the, you know, we're kind of looking at the wrong things, right? Like we have so many people in our country looking at these macroeconomic indicators that actually kind of obfuscate the inequality that underlies it, right? And so I do totally agree. Like we're not dealing with the core issues here. And I wanted to ask you guys about, you know, those solutions and how people are fighting back. I mean, Carla, there's the recall petitions going on in Alberta. I don't know how much luck they'll have with actually getting enough signatures, but it's at least sending a signal. And, you know, Emily, I mean, I think that you're going around speaking about the oligarchs and you know, calling this out and naming it. And I just wanted to ask both of you about how you hold on to hope and how we build resilience in the face of just like this downward spiral that Carla was just describing. I mean, you guys can have at her. I don't know who wants to go first. Oh, maybe I'll hey, Carla, you want to dive in?
This is the most amazing time alive to be someone on the left wing in Canada. Like I was hosting a rally a couple of weeks ago, and there were spontaneous shouts of general strike. By hundreds of people, not just like six of us in a pub. Like it, like you could openly talk about class consciousness. You could openly talk about corporate greed. You could openly talk about these things. There is an absolute huge explosion of political activity from groups and people and demographics that have for decades been silent. That the Zoomers are here and jumping into the fight, that old people are rallying in the streets and saying, wait, what is going on here? You know, you have people from every walk of life looking at things, talking about political life, economic life, human rights in very interesting and exciting ways. And that is larger than ever. I tell people in Alberta all the time, if 1,809 people voted differently, we had an NDP majority. It was that close in a few key ridings. So when we look at the recall petitions, I think at least one will win. I don't know if they're all going to, but right now we're up to 14. And I know that there's a couple more coming. There are people who are, they're coming after Mickey next, which as the justice minister who said that trans rights will be decided with the last voice in the legislature. Get him, go get him. Mickey, you are not so fine. Hey. Yeah, little drag, you know. But no, I think it's really exciting. I think at least one of these recall petitions will hit home because so many ridings in Calgary were like really close. Calgary went 16 of 30 seats in Calgary went NDP. It's not the conservative home bastion that it used to be. I do think that there's some people out there that are pretty upset and that we might see one or two flip because I think there's a lot of people waking up and realizing, hey, we can do better. There's examples out there.
Yeah. Emily, how about you? What are your thoughts on sort of maintaining that resiliency and fighting back?
Yeah, I can't help but feel like the horrors we are witnessing now are the death rattle of the old world. And I'm seeing cracks. I think here in BC, our campaign and this new leadership feels like, you know, a little spear in the hopelessness. And I think, yeah, it's really up to us to force this new world through. And I think with Daniel Smith, with Trump, and yeah, these fascist actors that are controlling our future, you know, I think we're seeing this flare because they can feel that their grip is loosening. And so I do see it as a death rattle. And I think more and more, you know, we're going to see people like myself, especially in the next provincial election in BC, step forward and, you know, like call it like it is and really breathe life into this moment. And I think for so long we've seen centrist governments make living conditions worse for everyday people because they're listening to the consultant class and lobbyists around them, the same old status quo playbook, Fossil Canada. And surprise, surprise, you know, working conditions, affordability have suffered. And so we're seeing massive amounts of working people who are looking desperately for solutions. And unfortunately, in the last election in BC, the Conservatives spoke into that desperation of working people, but they paired it with false solutions and they pitted marginalized groups against each other. And that's their playbook, right? And so as the left, you know, we need to talk about wealth inequality. We need to talk about taxing the rich and creating the real public agenda that would make life better for working people and to stop selling our province out to these corporations. So I think more and more people are realizing, you know, how we got here and who's to blame. And that makes me hopeful.
Carla has a hard out in about 5 minutes. So I did want to give the chat the opportunity if they had any questions before Carla has to run for her. So I'll give you guys a few seconds to drop those in before she jets. But while they do that, Carla, can you tell people where they can find you online so they can keep up with you if they loved your interventions and your jokes and your radical policies here today?
Yeah, I'm out there radicalizing the people being like, what if this helped people? You can find me at carla.marks1917 on Instagram. That's where I'm the most active. It's just like it says here, Carla with a K, Marks with an X. I can't believe that I have to spell that. I do. Like when I wrote that, I was like, everyone will know. And then I'm at like a show and some drunk girl comes up to me. She's like, you're amazing. What's your Instagram? I'm like, carla.marks1917, and she starts spelling it like Carla with a C and then Marks with a CKS, and I'm like,
oh,
Oh, maybe class consciousness is dead. But no, that's where you can find me the most. I'm also on X, the hellscape that it has become, at Karla Marx 1917. Yeah, so if you want to find me there on those places, that's where I'm most active. I'm on TikTok, but I pretty much exclusively take pictures and videos of trucks that I see around my, like when I'm like touring and I like take showgirl pictures of like, here's what it's like on the road. And those truck ones, that's what people want to see from me. Like, I'll put this like beautiful showgirl video up. No one cares. Trucks. We want to see truck bumper stickers. So I'm one for the people. I'll do that.
I love the idea of you like having this super right wing truck driving audience, not knowing, like not realizing who's running the account. And then you just like secretly, you know, get them to be super progressive with your and super pro trans rights. Yeah.
I love that idea. That is not the vibe. It is like,
I like it better that that's not the vibe.
Not the vibe. I like post these pictures of trucks and people, like some people are like, oh my gosh, this truck's so stupid. That bumper sticker's terrible. And then, and then all the truck men are like, actually, that's not a big truck. It's a regular F-150. I'm like, that's still a giant truck. Like, look at an F-150. Also,
that's so funny.
Somebody in there just put like, congratulations to Alberta on the MOU. And I love that we just all pretended that we have just been using this acronym MOU all the time. Like, I've seen it this time about the pipeline that everyone's using memorandum of like this MOU acronym, but I'm like, this is new. We don't use this. I've never seen this before. Now we're all like, all the cute, cool kids. What I'm saying is I'm annoyed that I am old enough that I have to Google things now like that. Like, you know, I like, what the hell does ICY am I? How to Google that? I don't know.
Yeah, there's too many. There's too many. There is one question in the chat. Someone asked, best Canadian socialist orgs to keep up with, especially being in Alberta. I don't know if you have any recommendations for them.
There's a really great group called the Alberta Advantage. They are a merry band of shitheads. I love them so much. They're based out of Calgary. Alberta Advantage is so, so cool. They do like a pod. They actually have a meetup group. There's like a Jacobin meetup group that they're associated with. That meets here in town, that talks about socialist things. I love them. Those are socialist ones specifically. Ninja Cupcake 13. Love the name. Yes, if you want broader organizations to keep in touch with, Transaction Alberta is really great. That's the provincial-wide group that's working to defend trans rights. Also, in my town, I'm involved with a group called Queer Citizens United, and where you focus on defending queer rights, but we're also very, you know, socialist and all that kind of stuff. So, yeah.
Great. Well, Karla, thank you so much for your time today. Emily's going to stick around for another 10 minutes, but we have to say goodbye to our lovely Alberta voice. So thank you so much for joining us.
Bye.
I really appreciate
thank
it.
You.
See ya. All right, Emily. So I did want to ask you a little bit about the drama that we're seeing within the liberal sort of camp as a result of this. I mean, there are a lot of partisans supporting this, but then we're also seeing people like Jody Wilson-Raybould has come out. I mean, obviously she's had her own spats with the Liberal Party as well, but Jody Wilson-Raybould came out and called out her former cabinet colleagues for doing, quote, the exact opposite of what they claimed to be committed to when I was there, total lack of principles and backbone. And Catherine McKenna shared a clip from CTV News wherein Minister Hodgson said that, well, she said, she quoted him saying that people who care about climate change, and that was a paraphrase, are, quote, dreaming nostalgically about the past. And Catherine McKenna said, gotcha, that explains a lot. I'm curious what you make of these sorts of cracks emerging, and maybe they've always been there within this Liberal Party, and what it tells us about where our politics are sort of heading and the popularity of this decision from the Liberal Party. Like, is this still the Liberal Party, or maybe it's always been this way and people are just realizing it? What are your thoughts on all this?
Yeah, it feels like Carney has used this moment with Trump as a Trojan horse to just double down on the same old business of Canada being a fossil fuel company, effectively, and owning more and more of these public resource projects. Yeah. And so I find it kind of fascinating to see sort of liberalism crack under its contradictions with this recent pipeline, because I think many of these ministers, some current and former, you know, really struggle with this oil pipeline proposal. And I think like the Liberal Party has tried to sort of keep this guise of like green progressivism, you know, like they entertained the oil and gas emissions cap, but then diluted it to the point of, you know, irrelevance, and then, you know, cowed to Smith's pressure to get rid of the cap, you know. And so there's so many examples where they are unwilling to actually challenge production, to challenge these projects, to challenge expansion. And I think that's because, you know, we have a liberal party that is liberal. They're unwilling to get below the surface and challenge our economic system, you know, and stand up to the large corporations that are really running the show behind the scenes. And so, you know, the public is always surprised when there's like, you know, these contradictions come to light. And, you know, I think that's why the Liberal Party always comes across as like performative or greenwashing, or, you know, having these sort of like cultural proclamations that aren't actually backed up by substance. And I think that's what people are so sick of, because we don't see that. Yeah, that's about the least effective strategy for an energy and a workers transition, right? And so, yeah, I find it's notable that we're seeing a lot more sort of publicly disgruntled former ministers and former MPs. You know, it's a lot of women who are like coming out and challenging this old boys club and this like fossil fuel run show that is really only serving the big corporations in Canada. So I do find it's quite interesting to see that fracture across feminist lines.
Yeah, it's really interesting, particularly when coupled with, you know, other critiques that have come out about Carney's PMO. I mean, we heard from, I had liberal sources telling me that there was a vibe that it was a real boys club. And it's fascinating watching the sort of broader implications of that culture on the broader Liberal Party in conversations. Emily, I know you also have a hard out in about just over 5 minutes. So I'm going to give the chat an opportunity once again to drop in some questions for you. And while they do that, can you tell people where they can keep up with you?
Yeah, you can keep up with me on most platforms at Emily Lowen. So it's just my name. And yeah, I'm on Instagram most, I'm on Blue Sky, and I'm on Mastodon as well, if you keep up there. And it's a niche following. I hope the platform grows. We need more anti-oligarch digital platforms. But yeah, and I also, if you want to join me on tour, if you're on BC, I'm about halfway through my tour. I'm headed to the mainland later today. So check out my upcoming events at fighttheoligarchs.ca.
Yeah, nice. All right. So this is a fun one. Olafin the Husky, we've got a husky asking a question, which is adorable, says, what do you think about rephrasing oil and gas as liquid exploding dinosaurs? Just like paper format is dead tree format. Just reframing it like that and make people reconsider their ways. Well, what do you think? Should we start calling oil and gas liquid exploding dinosaurs?
I'm obsessed. Don't be surprised if you see that in an upcoming video. Thank you, Olafin the Husky, for this brilliant suggestion. Yeah, I think we, you know, there's just to, I don't know. Yeah, we get caught up in like technocratic terms and jargon, and it's so refreshing when people, you know, tell it like it is. And I think we need much more straightforward communication when this old boys club is constantly trying to make a death economy seem reasonable.
Another question here from Kairos Rev. They want to know, are your anti-oligarchical positions in practice anti-capitalist? And how do you feel about anti-capitalism as a revolutionary stance?
Yeah, absolutely. I see my fight against the oligarchs as an entry point to challenging capitalism as a whole. And I think it's important to, like, you know, name names and to look at the individuals that are hoarding so much of the wealth, so much of the resources in our province. And so that's what my Fight the Oligarchs tour is really about. I've been going around to communities and speaking to folks on the front lines of corporate resource theft who, you know, have these foreign multinationals come into their communities, strip the forests, lay down oil and gas pipes, tailing ponds, you name it. And many of these companies just skip town when profits change. They go to the US and they leave hundreds, sometimes thousands of workers in the lurch. And so, you know, as I traveled the province, this is the story that I wanted to share. And it's repeated across industries. It's always communities, nations, and municipalities that are left footing the bill for these multinationals. And there are some really inspiring ways that people are fighting back and reclaiming their economy. And those are the solutions that I want to fight for. You know, good union jobs, free transit, community healthcare centers, sustainable, self-reliant communities. And so, yeah, I think the more we can get out of book club world in our anti-capitalism, the better. And I say that with all the love in my heart. I think we need to get down on the ground. We need to build power with people who don't look or think like leftists, right? And there's so many of them out there who have, you know, really faced the oligarchs in live time and are fighting back in some inspiring ways.
And I know we're almost at time here, but I'm going to just group together two questions quickly, and you kind of already answered part of it. Discordant Muse wants to know, we need some strategies to win over Northern BC. Any suggestions? And Knox the Goat says, hoping you come to Central Vancouver Island for your tour. Emily, how would you sell voting green in the next election to older boomer BC NDP voters? So I guess sort of the broader question to couple all that together is, how do you win over this, you know, Northern BC and older boomer voters?
Yeah, absolutely. So in Northern BC, what I heard so much of was leave us alone, give us, you know, the resources to do what we're already doing. And to reclaim their communities, because so often it's people down in Victoria that are sending these foreign multinationals up to these territories without the consent of nations. And they have so many of those communities have food security and are like building real alternatives to live on the land and with real community. And so, yeah, I think it's we need to talk about the ways that, you know, we're there in solidarity to support the real alternatives that those communities want, that aren't just going to, you know, extract more from their communities. And yeah, I found it funny how so many of them actually really understood the term oligarchy in like such a lived, visceral way, of course, right? It's not just something that down Southers use. And it really speaks to the lived experience. And yeah, there's a real appetite to tax the richest corporations and the 1% to fund those alternatives across the province. And speaking to the older boomer BC NDP voters, I think there's multiple demographics here, but the people that I want to be building power with the most are young people and non-voters. And I think by doing that, by inspiring the disillusioned and the disaffected, by building power with workers, renters, Indigenous communities, young people across the province, I think that will build the formidable political movement that we need to gain ground in the next election. And we shouldn't be pandering necessarily to older boomer voters, but I think some of them are down for sure. and I think there's also a huge segment of older BCNDP voters that have been with the party since it got started, when the party was in opposition and has frankly transformed and morphed into something that doesn't resemble itself whatsoever. And so I think what I'm hearing from a lot of older NDP voters is they're coming over to the BC Greens because they no longer feel represented by the party. It's no longer the party for workers and for the people, it's for corporations. Mm-hmm.
Great. Well, Emily, thank you for being so generous with your time. I kept you a little bit over your heart out, so I'll let you get out of here. But thank you so much for everything today. And I'll see you again in like 2 weeks, I guess, with the schedule we're keeping up here.
Yeah, no, please. Let's keep it rolling. Yeah.
All right. Thanks so much, Rachel. Take care. Thanks again. Bye.
Bye.
Thank you for listening to this week's episode of Bubble Pop. I'm Rachel Gilmore, your least favorite person's least favorite journalist. If you enjoyed this episode, consider subscribing on YouTube, Patreon, Substack, or wherever you like to listen. You can also find me on TikTok, Instagram, Twitch, and Blue Sky. I'd like to give a special thank you to Hans Vivian Wenzel for making the incredibly groovy music for Bubble Pop. You can find more of his stuff on Spotify under the artist name Hans. That's a lowercase h with an exclamation mark. Thank you again for spending this time with me. This is my dream job. I know I say that every week, but that's because it's true every week, and I couldn't do it for 1 second without your support. So thank you, and I'll see you next time.